Good morning. So by profession, I am not a teacher of Torah. I teach panel studies, I teach history. So for a number of years that I spoke at these sorts of things, I went outside my professional boundaries and I taught Torah. But then I realized two things. Well, really I realized two things that are one thing, which is that there are many more people who are much more qualified to teach Torah than I am, so I don't have to leave it to them. And also there are other things that I want to talk about. There are things that I want to talk about which are big and important issues in our community, things that we as a community struggle with, wrestle with, and think about, that do not necessarily always lend themselves neatly to here are four sources and here's a psak at the end, but that are much more explorations of topics. And if you came here hoping for an answer by which at the end of 45 minutes I would resolve all of your uncertainties and leave you with certainty, I apologize because I'm not going to do that. And so this is really going to be much more of an exploration or a conversation than we will work through the sources and get to a conclusion. The setting here doesn't lend itself all that naturally to conversation, but if you have something you'd like to say or a contribution you'd like to make or a point of mind you'd like to disagree with, by all means, please raise your hand and get involved. The first thing I'd like to do is define the terms that I'm working with, because I think it's important before I start to talk a lot about certainty and uncertainty to understand what I mean when I speak about certainty and uncertainty. I do not mean when I say certainty, knowing what you believe or having confidence that what you believe is correct. Orthodox Judaism calls it certainty. The certainty of knowing what we believe and having confidence that what we believe is correct is the position of anima amin be'emunah shlema, which of course we are all called upon to do. That's not what I'm talking about when I'm talking about certainty and uncertainty. What I am talking about is the stance that there can be no position other than the one that I hold, or certainly that there can be no position other than the one that I hold, motivated by genuine Yiran Shamayim, concern for the Jewish people, well-intentionedness, or anything else. If someone holds a position other than the one that I hold, they must be stupid, not from, motivated by malice or animus, or something else. There can be no position other than the one that I hold, held by thoughtful, well-intentioned, reasonable, from concerns about the Jewish people. When we think about certainty and uncertainty in those ways, I think our first reflexive response is to say, well, no, we as a community, the mono-Orthodox community, the centrist Orthodox community, the YU community writ large, whatever you'd like to call ourselves, we do not struggle with that sort of thing. That sort of problem or concern about that sort of certainty that admits no other position or perspective, or certainly admits no other position or perspective motivated by anything other than stupidity, animus, or lack of frumkeit, that is a problem in other segments of the Orthodox community, but it is not a problem in ours. Would that it were so. I wish that that were the case. I often do not think it is. I think that our community struggles very much and very often with that sort of certainty, even as we sometimes tell ourselves that those problems are the problems of another segment of the community. It's true. We generally tend not to be in the business of banning books. That is, other segments of Orthodox, they tend to be in the business of banning books. But in other ways, our community is rather adept. I once pulled the geometry of the Orthodox community, which is we draw circles and we put some people inside the circle and some people outside the circle. So even absent the book burnings, book bannings, no book burnings, even after that was, you know, 1200. We as a community have been there also, but we seem to have gotten past that. But even absent the book bannings, we as a community certainly have found many ways to say very clearly, only these are the positions that right-minded, right-thinking, good people hold, and all other positions are only held by people, again, who are motivated by stupidity, animus, or lack of frumkeit, or yirat shamayim. And I think that we as a community need to do some serious cheshbon ha-nefesh about that posture, about that position, about where it takes us, and about where it leaves us. And I think that as the opening text for thinking about this and for thinking about an alternate possibility, I'd like us to look at source number four, Rabbi Yehuda Levi from Sefer Akuzot. as a model of what it looks like to be able to say, Ani ma'amin be'emunah shlema, not to be lacking in one's own conviction, not to be feeble in one's own conviction, but to grant decency, good motives, good intentions to people who do not share those convictions or beliefs. So we are probably all familiar with the backstory of Sefer HaKuzari. Sefer HaKuzari is a philosophical work written by Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi, and it is a philosophical work written in the form of a conversation or a dialogue that takes place. The king of the Kuzarim is trying very hard to figure out how he's supposed to be living in the world. He's trying very hard to be a good person. And no matter how much he tries to be a good person, here's what happens to him. He keeps having this dream. And what happens in this dream is, I'm on the first line now in the Hebrew. It's the end of the second line, the English. An angel is speaking to him, ve'omerlo, and says to him, kavanatecha ritzuya, your intentions are desired, your intentions are good, ve'eneha eloka, in God's eyes, aval ma'asecha eino ratzui, but your actions are not desirable in God's eyes. And the king doesn't know why he keeps having this dream. And so he is very careful. He is zahir ma'od. He is very diligent and scrupulous in observing dat ha-kuzarim, in observing whatever the local religion of the kuzarim was. Until he himself, atchahu atzmo yemeshamesh ba'echal asher lehem, umakrib korbanot, b'lev shalem. He himself is going to offer sacrifices in the temple of the kuzarim to whoever the deity of the kuzarim happens to be. And yet, no matter what he does, and no matter how he tries to observe the mitzvot of the kuzarim with greater scrupulousness, he keeps getting this malach near Ailav, Laila, Laila, the beginning of the fourth line from the top. The angel appears to him night after night, ve'omerlo kavanatecha ritzuya, aval ma'asecha eino ratzui. But your actions are not desirable. And so in the story review that Levi tells in the kuzari, he eventually brings various representatives of various faiths to come argue their faiths before him, to make their case, to explain to him why he should adopt their faith, because he clearly realizes the faith that he's practicing is not the one that's desired, because he keeps having this disturbing dream. And eventually, of course, the chaver, the Jewish scholar, the Jewish wise man, comes to speak to him and convinces him, and he and his entire people convert to Judaism. But what I think is important for us, for our purposes about this story, is here we have a man who's being an Oved Avodah Zarah. He is worshiping idols. Whatever he's doing in his temple of the Kuzarim, whatever deities he's offering sacrifices to, it's clearly not God. This, of course, is not only a violation for Jews, it's a violation for non-Jews. It's a violation of one of the Zionists of Ne'noah. The dream he has does not say, you're a terrible, horrible sinner, and thoroughly no good person, and what are you doing here? The dream he has keeps reassuring him, your intentions are good, and we recognize the goodness of your intentions, even though you are going about it in entirely the wrong way. So I figure, if at least in the story that Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi is telling us, God, through his emissary, the angel, can say to the king of the Kuzarim, who's worshipping idols, your intentions are good, but you're going about it the wrong way, we in our communal discourse should be more able than we sometimes seem to be to say to people, you're wrong, but I recognize that your intentions are good. I recognize that you too are trying to do what you think is right by God, or right by the Jewish people, or right by the state of Israel. And I think you're wrong, and I think what you're doing is not helpful. You can say all of that. But that's different than saying, go look at the first source. Yes?
But the order is different. First, he's already said, your intentions are good, and but your actions are wrong. Rather than what you just said was...
Either way. But I think that we as a community sometimes get to the point of, if your actions are wrong, your intentions must also be lousy. So because this is not, as I said to you, a shir in your standard understanding of the word shir, so my sources are probably not your standard sources, and your standard understanding of the word sources. So here's a poem by Stephen Crane. If you have met Stephen Crane, you have probably met him through the novel that bedevils junior high school or ninth grade literature classes, which is The Red Badge of Courage. If you encountered that at some point or remember it. Here is a poem of Stephen Crane's. Think as I think, said a man, or you are abominably wicked. You are a toad. And after I thought of it, I said, I will then be a toad. Leaving off the second part for a moment, which is the response to this kind of challenge, I think sometimes we are a little bit too close to think as I think, or you are abominably wicked, you are a toad. And I'd like to talk about that posture, why I think we sometimes adopt that posture, and what the dangers of adopting that posture are. And then if we have time, we'll also get to faith and doubt, which is really a different, although related, conversation.
Can you give some concrete examples?
Yes, we're getting there. Absolutely, 100%. So, why we might embrace this posture of certainty. The obvious reason to embrace this posture is that it is comforting and clear. If there is only one right way, and it is the way I am doing it, if there is only one right way of thinking about this issue, and it is the way I am thinking about it, then I can be comfortable, I can be certain, I can be at ease, I can know that I am doing the right thing, I do not have to be disturbed or challenged or discomfited by engaging with perspectives that challenge my own, that ask me to defend my own, that ask me if I really know, if I'm really sure that I am right. And I think that in a world, once upon a time, most of us, I mean our ancestors obviously, lived in a world that was that way because it was that way. You lived in a small town. In a small town, you knew one way of doing things. That's the way it was, right? You knew the nusach your shul daven, you knew the psak your rabbi handed down, you knew the positions, the ways things were done in your town. That's how things were, so that's how they were. Somewhere very, very far away, there might have been other people, other Jews who did things differently, but you didn't meet them, you didn't encounter them, you didn't know about them. Somebody came back once and traveled from far away and said, oh wow, I met these other Jews and they did things very differently. But that wasn't a reality of your life. The reality of our lives today, and this is really a reality from the time, even before the disruptions of World War II, from the time the disruptions had Jews starting to move into big cities in Eastern Europe and out of the small towns, and certainly once we get to large Jewish populations concentrated in New York or in Israel where we are all living together on top of each other, is that there are many different possibilities and many different ways and many different avenues and many different options. And I don't have the certainty of knowing that there is only one way because I see many, many different ways all around me, right? And so sometimes we revert to saying those other ways have to all be wrong, have to all be based on something no good, because that lets me be in a posture of certainty and comfort and not having to be uncomfortable in dealing with these issues. A former student of mine came to talk to me about last week or 2 weeks ago about a dating situation that he's in now and he's trying to navigate his way through. And I was talking to him about the reality that when you're making decisions about whom to marry, it's not like buying a warranty. You don't get a warranty, right? You're making a decision and you're making the best judgment you can, but nobody's giving you a guarantee that this is going to turn out the way you want it to turn out, and if you're waiting for that, you're not going to get one. And I would say, I in the course of having this conversation, I said that I think that some of the appeal of the ideology of Das Torah, right, of the idea that one consults with rabbinic leadership not only to ask questions of Jewish law or Jewish practice, but even to ask questions about what school should I send my kids to, or should I take this job or not, or is this person the right person for me to marry, is that it gives you certainty in a place where you're uncertain. Because even if I don't know that I can have come to the right answer, if the Rav, if the Rosh Hashiva told me this is what I'm supposed to do, then I know that this is what I'm supposed to do, not because they have any more of a guarantee about the spouse than I have about the spouse, but because I know I'm supposed to listen to them. And so that gives me certainty, and that gives me comfort. And the discomfort that comes from making a decision, which is, I tell my students this all the time, I teach high school, so they complain about, you know, we have so much work, and we have SATs, and we have tests, and we have to apply for college, and life is so hard. I say, no, life is not hard when you're taking a test, and the question is, how are you going to learn that? Life is hard when you have these questions, and you don't know what the right answer is, and you will never know what the right answer is. Am I raising my kids the right way? I don't know. Come back to me in 20 years, and we'll find out if I raised my kids the right way. There's no way, right? How do you know this? And in those areas in which life is very challenging and uncertain sometimes, so being able to create a sense of certainty, I know I'm right because no other position has any validity or legitimacy, can be a very comforting place to be. And I think sometimes that's why we reach for that kind of certainty, because it can be very difficult otherwise. I was riding up in the elevator of a gentleman who told me he was coming to hear this talk and said that he saw my title and knew that I would be dishing up a serving of existential angst. So So when we look for that kind of certainty, we protect ourselves from existential angst. There's only one way, or there's only one right answer. I'm doing it. I'm following it. There's nothing to be honest about it. So that's all great. And so that, I think, is why we, especially in a world now of so many options and so many choices, DAFKA, because we don't know only one way, but we know so many ways, and having to figure out the right way from among the so many ways can be challenging, confusing, hard to wrestle with, that seeking that kind of certainty that there is only one right answer and I know it and I'm following it can be so appealing. But I think there are very, very, very real dangers and risks to us as a community in embracing this kind of certainty, even as it comforts us, even as it allows us to have confidence in our day-to-day decisions, even as it allows us to set our minds at ease. I want to look now at some very, very different sources to raise some of the dangers that we face as a community when we embrace that kind of certainty. For the first danger, I want to go to the last source. The last source is a poem by the modern Israeli poet Yehuda Amichai. I know that there is an egregious typo in the third line. That was how I found it online, and I couldn't. It was just like a copying and paste of a block. I couldn't edit it. It's mukul as a fat, not a fat. We all understand that. But let's now talk about Hamakom Shebo Anutzokit, the place in which we are right. Min hamakom shebo anu tzokim lo yitzmuchu olam prachin ba'avir. From the place where we are ripe, flowers will never grow in the spring. Hamakom shebo anu tzokim hu ramus v'kasher kimo chatzer. The place where we are ripe is hard and trampled like a yard. Aval sveikot v'ahavot osim et ha'olam l'tchoach. Doubts and loves dig up the world. K'moch farferet, k'moch harish. Like a mole, right? You know, mole, a little creature digging under the ground, digging tunnels, digging holes. U'lechishat yishama b'makom, shebo haya habayit asher necherav. And a whisper will be heard in the place where the ruined house once stood. Now, I think here is a place, by the way, where the English translation fails, because I think habayit asher necherav, when you hear those words in Hebrew, the house that was destroyed, I think very clearly the people with a certain sense of Jewish literacy is also a reference to the destruction of Beit HaMikdash, which we'll talk about in a couple of minutes. It's not just about a house being destroyed. So I think that the English translation, which was taken from the website that I cited to, misses something here, but in any case. This idea that when we know that we are right, the ground is hard and trampled down and nothing grows there, nothing new comes out. We as a community are losing something. We are losing something because we are not engaging with ideas. We are losing something in the sophistication of the way we think. We are losing something in the openness to new concepts, new ideas, new challenges. Last year, I was the faculty advisor. Last year, I taught in SAR High School, and I was the faculty advisor at SAR High School newspaper. And Shel Heaven High School in Los Angeles hosted a conference for Jewish school newspaper editors and staff. It was a really very interesting conference, wonderfully well done. The kids got a lot of time to think about both issues that come up in school journalism and issues that specifically come up in from school journalism, which are different from issues that come up in school journalism in general. And one of the speakers who spoke to us was David Suisa, who writes for the Jewish newspaper in Los Angeles. I forgot what it's called. It's like the equivalent of the Jewish Week or the Jewish Link here. So there's a Jewish newspaper in LA, and he spoke to, he gave one of his sessions to the students, and he said something very powerful that I've been quoting ever since. He said, people think that the hardest thing to do is to give. He said, nonsense. It is very easy to give. Giving puts you in the dominant position, in the powerful position, in the position of one who has and is ready to endow to somebody else what you have. David Suisa said, what is hard to do is to take. And he was speaking, let's just say very clearly what he was speaking about, he was speaking specifically about Orthodox Jews in relation to other denominations. He was saying Orthodox Jews are perfectly happy to go to conservative temples, to reform temples, and say, let me teach you my Torah, let me tell you what I know, because I have it and you don't, and you listen to me. David Suisa was saying, but they are not similarly ready to say, and what do you have to say, and what do you have to teach me? Now, putting in very big brackets here that I understand that we are dealing with halachic questions of interdenominational Torah teaching dialogue conversation and everything else. And as I said, I don't pass in halacha. I'm not equipped to. There are other people who are, and halacha questions can be raised to them. But I think that the assumption that because we are more faithful to halachic tradition, we therefore have a monopoly on having the right answers to all the hard questions is maybe something that we should think about. We can say we are more faithful to halachic tradition, but there may be places where there is room to hear how other people answer the hard questions. So it is a trope in our community, it is a recurring theme in our community to poke fun at, sometimes gentle and sometimes less gentle, to poke fun at the concern for the betterment of the world, for social justice, for tikkun olam, that tends to emanate from the more liberal Jewish denominations, right? I'm not telling anyone anything they don't know when I say there is a tendency in our community to do such fun poking. And again, to the extent that we're saying that tikkun olam or social justice doesn't replace the observance of halakha, we are right. I said that what I'm talking about here is not a lack of confidence in the rightness of our stance. We understand that we are called upon to observe halakha, and that concern for other important issues doesn't obviate the need for importance of halakha. I am not advocating for a stance in which we aren't certain of whether we should be keeping halakha or not, right? That is not what I'm advocating. That is not what I'm calling for here. But here's the but. Here's the big but. If you read the words of the Torah, which I highly recommend that we do every so often, because it's a good thing to do. I'm being a little bit funny, but it's actually, sometimes I find that when I talk to my students about what it actually says in the Pesukim, they're so busy taking in messages that they haven't spent so much time engaging what it actually says in the Pesukim. The God who wrote the Torah is very concerned with social justice issues. Yes. He's forever talking about widows and orphans and strangers. He spends a lot of time on poor people. He spends a lot of time worried about the widows and the orphans and strangers and the poor people. I'm not making this up, right? This is not the liberal 21st century New York. You could go read Chavit Lachem Shetor. I promise you it's in there. The Nevi'im Acharonim are full of exhortations to stop bringing korbanot and just start doing what I told you to do in terms of, right? Chazon Yishayahu, the Haftarah that we read on the Shabbos before Tisha B'Av every single year. So again, this is not some marginal text, and this is not some recently invented text. This is Yeshayahu's Nebuah that introduced him to us in Parak Aleph of Yeshayahu. And what does he say? He says, you come to trample it, right? Ki tavo le'ra'o panai, you come to see my face. Mi b'kech zot mi'edchem r'mos chatzei rai. Who asked you to come trampling in my courtyard? Trampled the courtyards, right? That comes from Yeshayahu. Who asked you to come trampling in my courtyard, bringing korbanot? What did I ask you to do? I asked you not to monkey with your weights and measures. That's what it says there, right? I asked you not to adulterate your wine. I asked you to do justice. I asked you to listen to the cries of those people who are being oppressed. That's what it says in Yeshayahu Parakal. And so there is room for us to say we are right on the matter of halachic observance, but maybe those Jews who say we should also have a more active engagement with questions of tzedek, with questions of social justice, with questions of making the world a better, fairer place, are in fact reminding us of another part of the Torah's teaching that maybe we haven't paid as much attention to as we should. Being open to hearing does not mean not being certain that our position about being halachically observant is correct. It only means knowing that other people may be saying other things motivated by genuine desire to do good in the world, to figure out what God wants of us in the world, and that sometimes there may be something that we can learn from hearing that even as we retain our emunah shlema and our commitment to our halachic observance. So the first danger of certainty, if we're going back to that, is that it limits us. It limits what we can know. It limits what we can think about. We cut ourselves off from a whole world of ideas and a whole world of things that there are to learn and know about. I didn't put this in the source sheet because I don't know if it's a real source. I'm very careful. I try to be very careful to distinguish between when I'm quoting something that I know someone actually said and when I'm quoting something apocryphal. So the Fitzgerald quote that's in here that we haven't gotten to yet, and I'm not sure we will, I didn't put it any. I heard this with, well, let's go to it now because I'm talking about it. So, source number two, F. Scott Fitzgerald. The test of a first-grade intelligence is the ability to hold two ideas, two opposed ideas in mind at the same time and still retain the ability to function. So I heard this quote for many years. It's a great quote. I love it. It's obviously very relevant to what we're talking about today. But I never could actually use it for anything because I didn't know if Fitzgerald said it or not. You found loads of stuff on the internet attributed to Lincoln that Lincoln clearly never said. One school that I taught in had this great idea to put plaques up on the doors, like in honor of the donors, you know, put plaques up on the doors in honor of the donors. With like a meaningful quote about education in every room, just to, along with the donor's name, this classroom donor, I just finished the short. And on one room on the floor that I was on, they had a plaque with a quote that said, I'm a great believer in luck, and I find the harder I work, the more I have of it. And the quote was attributed to Thomas Jefferson. So I went to the business office and I said, Thomas Jefferson never said that. I don't know everything Thomas Jefferson ever said, but I know he didn't say that. That's not how people talked or wrote or sounded in the late 18th century. I bet if you look into it, you're going to find that that's like a late 19th century quote. That's a Mark Twain or Thomas Edison or Anton Mencken. Somebody said that and it wasn't Thomas Jefferson. Indeed, if you go to the website of Monticello, Jefferson's home, which is now a museum, they have a whole part of their website just devoted to quotes that are mistakenly attributed to Thomas Jefferson. Jefferson never said it. Apparently, he's the person you hang anything on. Anything you have, you want to say Thomas Jefferson said it. So I had this quote from F. Scott Fitzgerald that I could never use because I didn't exactly for sure know that he said it. And then one day I was on a plane. I took a book out of the library to read on a plane. It was a book of the best American essays of the 20th century. And I opened up an essay written by F. Scott Fitzgerald. And there it is, the quote. F. Scott Fitzgerald actually said this, so we can use it. And I think actually, now that I've talked about it, let's just weave it in here because it's relevant here. The ability to keep two opposed ideas in the mind that want to continue to function means that I can say, well, at least if I have a first-grade intelligence by definition of F. Scott Fitzgerald, I can say, I know that our approach to halakhic observance is the correct approach. I am confident in that. I do not lack any clarity about that. And yet, at the same time, I can also hold in my mind the idea that other people who are not halakhically observant may have something to say that is genuine and meaningful about the Jewish tradition, or that certainly at least is motivated by meaningful religious motivations, even if I think they're wrong about this. And I can hold those two ideas in my mind at once and continue to function. So the source I didn't put in here because I don't really know if he said it, even though everybody around quotes him as saying it, but it's a great quote anyway, whoever said it. And if you ever track it down one day, please let me know. Niels Bohr, the great Danish scientist, is supposed to have said, there are two kinds of truths, great truths and small truths. The opposite of a small truth is a lie. The opposite of a great truth is also truth. If we believe that many of the questions that we are wrestling with in the Torah world today are great truths, meaning that there is something to be said on both sides of the issue, okay? If there is something to be said on both sides of the issue. Whether we are talking about the various ways in which orthodoxy contends with modernity, or whether we are talking about what will secure the future and well-being of the state of Israel, or whether we are talking about any of the many very complex issues we deal with in the world today, and we think that there is a great truth on this side and a great truth on that side, and we have to somehow wrestle to put them both together, then that means that if I say there is only one way, only one approach, only one truth, I'm shutting myself off from another great truth. And so I think that, to wrap up the first danger of certainty, I think the first danger of certainty is that on issues in which there are great truths implicated and involved, we sometimes, in pursuit of certainty about this great truth, we sometimes close ourselves off from hearing about that one. There is a much more down on the ground, less lofty, it'll cut us off from great truth danger of this kind of certainty. And to talk about that one, I go right to the heavy hitter, source number five. Rav Aaron Lichtenstein spoke at Yeshivat Har Etzion in the wake of the assassination of Yitzhak Rabin. He was actually in America when the assassination happened. He went back to Israel about a week later, and he spoke to the yeshiva then. So it was a little bit more than a week after the assassination of Rabin. And for those of you who remember this, that assassination occasioned a tremendous amount of soul-searching in the Dati Leumi world, about the religious Zionist world, about the extent to which the rhetoric around Rabin and around the Oslo peace process had contributed to something horrible happening. I was actually in Israel for my year of seminary the year before the assassination, 94, 95. And that rhetoric about Rabin Bogave and how Rabin is a traitor, right, that was everywhere. That slogan, Rabin Bogave, was everywhere. Rabin is a traitor. And the talk in certain circles about him having the halachic status of being a rodef, right? A rodef is a pursuer whom halachically one is permitted to kill because he is seeking to cause your death. So halachically permitted to kill. And all this kind of rhetoric was out there, and I'm sure had you called anyone on it at the time, they would have said, it's just rhetoric. It's not. Nobody really expects someone to get up and... But then somebody did. And Ryan Lichtenstein gave a long talk to the yeshiva, which you can find online here, in which he says, we cannot say to ourselves, we cannot comfort ourselves by saying, this person was an outlier. This person was an exception. This person was unbalanced. This person was unhinged. Rav Aaron says, you can't say that. That's a convenient out, but it's not legitimate. He said, we have to own the part of this that came from within our community and the way, whether we meant to be conveying this or we allowed our rhetoric to carry us away from ourselves, the things we conveyed to our students and to our young people. Okay? So I want to read a little bit. Again, this is an excerpt. I cut out much of it, but I want to read a little bit of it starting from the first paragraph I gave you. There are several points I would suggest as worthy of reflection. First, the self-confidence that arises from commitment and devotion to a world of values and eternal truths, whether in terms of Torah Yisrael or Eretz Yisrael, sometimes has led to frightening levels of self-certainty and ultimately to arrogance. This arrogance has sometimes led us to act without sufficient responsibility towards other people, at times even without responsibility to other values. We are good, we have values, and they are worthless. This attitude has seeped deeper and deeper into our consciousness. Now that is at a different level than it makes us simple-minded and not sophisticated thinkers, which is actually the second thing that Ron speaks about. That is a really, we have delegitimated other people. We have made other people or other points of view so not legitimate and so not acceptable that we have lost sight of other values that we hold as Jews as well, whether it is the community of Klal Yisrael that involves all Jews, or whether it's a much more fundamental level as the Tzelem Elokim of all human beings. Let's skip because it's late. And yes?
As you were speaking, I was perusing this and just browsing to see what he says. Actually, one of the things that you are skipping because of time, but I'll just paraphrase it really quickly, is that Rabbi Lichtenstein walked out, I never knew this until I read this, walked out meeting of religious leaders because they said he could love the Rambam, and Rambam disagree about Yeshiva versus Yisrael. We don't mention to the students, they'll lose their fervor for settling in Israel. He walked out because he felt that was glossing over a debate about whether you're supposed to live in Israel or not. So certainly, since you've been in two high schools, or at least that you referenced, and here we have a crowd of people who are past high school and college, others who are in college and so on. This here is, from what you said, is something that is, essential material. Adults like to think that even if we're serving, we have a sense of sincerity of others. You can go ahead with the example that you gave, being able to see from the other religious camps or the denominational camps things that might be of merit and even still feel that we are certain. But this here, and I'm going to highlight just very quickly, is the educational message for parents to teach their kids and for kids to try to get even as younger people is this is the time when people are younger to try to learn, even with all the anthems and the slogans of youth life in camp and in school, this is the time to try to understand that these things that we rally around have a lot of subtleties and tonality. So I'm sharing that because I'd like to just pull out into something and also, feel an affinity with what you deal with as an educator, and how do we get youth in the younger years, and those are slightly long, my apologies, how do we get youth to go ahead and be able to see the subtleties and tonalities when they get older, when they sit in class like this, we don't have in society the same types of problems that you're, and we are wrestling with.
I have to say that I do not at all see this as exclusively... I do not at all see this as exclusively being a problem of the kids. And if anything, I, as somebody who has worked with teenagers my entire professional career, sees kids sometimes as being open to being pushed to being to think differently, at least to hear that there's another point of view out there, in a way that I actually often find that with people who are more mature and more certain in the things they think, it is young people are sort of plastic. Yes, they come in with opinions largely formed by parental home or by summer camp or by what Rebbe has taught them, but they can hear what you're saying and they can think through it. I think we have not yet gotten to where we're trying to get. But when we start to talk about Israel and Israeli politics in our communities, in our centrist Orthodox, modern Orthodox, YU, whatever we want to call a community, the range of acceptable positions that one can express, I think, is very narrow. It's very narrow indeed. And people, including, let's say this, people who are living in Israel, not we who are living in America who are opining about Israel, but people who are living in Israel, people who have served in Sahel, not we who are opining about whatever, but people who have actually put their lives on the line, and we are very comfortable delegitimating those people sometimes if what they are saying does not exactly align with the way we think about things or what we think is the correct position. And I think at a minimum to be able to say, I think you're wrong. I think what you're saying is terrible and dreadful. I think if your plans were followed, they would be bad for the Jews, bad for Israel. You could say all of that. But I recognize that you too are motivated by what you think is the best thing to do for Israel, the Jewish people. And as much as I might disagree with you about that, I do not say, I have to tell you, I'm deeply troubled by the rhetoric in our community that casts, forget a whole other conversation we have about the rhetoric around, you know, anti-Semitism on college campuses, which is a different conversation. I don't want to have that now, although one day. But the rhetoric around other Jews, other committed Jews, other Israelis, again, other veterans of Saha, who don't see things the way we see them, and the willingness to take those people and toss them over the line, to me is and I certainly do not see that only among 16-year-olds. That is not the exclusive province of 16-year-olds, those kinds of positions. I'm actually going to jump from here. There's much more. Read the rest of what Rav Aaron Lichtenstein says. It's really worth reading what Rav Aaron Lichtenstein says. But I'm just going to skip to the very end. And I'm going to tell you that when Shimon Peres visited Yeshiva in 1978, he asked me, this is Rav Aaron still speaking, what the political credo of Yeshiva was. I told him Yeshiva has no political credo, but we teach three things. Number one, even when sitting in the Beit Midrash, you have a responsibility to the community. Two, when addressing these problems, you have to think deeply and not simplistically. Three, even when doing what is right, you have to know how to respect other opinions and the people who hold them. Okay, so now I want to skip to an article from The New Yorker. The New Yorker, this is source number three. The New Yorker, last month in November, did a profile of the current president of the state of Israel, Ruvi Rivlin. Okay? And they talked about the fact that he, who is very much not on the left wing of the Israeli political spectrum, has spoken out about certain kinds of racist rhetoric, specifically against Arabs in Israel, and has found himself under virulent attack for doing so. Okay? Second paragraph. Around Rosh Hashanah, the Jewish New Year, Rivlin made a video which she sat next to an 11-year-old Palestinian Israeli boy from Jaffa who had been bullied. The two held up cards to the camera calling for empathy, decency, and harmony. We are exactly the same, one pair read. A couple of weeks ago, Rivlin visited the Arab town of Kafr Qasim to apologize for the massacre in 1956 of 48 Palestinian workers and children by Israeli border guards. Okay? Next paragraph. Every Israeli and Palestinian understands the context of these remarks. In recent years, anti-Arab harassment and vitriol have reached miserable levels. So here's Rivlin talking to the Knesset. I have been called lying little Jew by my critics. Damn your name, Arab Asian. Go be president in Gaza. Disgusting psychophant, rotten filth, lowest of the low, traitor, president of Hezbollah. These are just a few of the things that have been said to me in the wake of events I've attended and speeches I've made. I must say that I've been horrified by the thuggishness that has permeated the national dialogue. Again, we as a community writ large, and this is certainly, he's obviously talking about the broader Israeli body politic. He's not talking about what's going on within our communities. But we see the same thing very much. It's actually interesting because it's not only in our communities. In the wake of this summer, it seems it's this conversation about how we have a conversation, right? This conversation about how we have a conversation in which we are convinced of our positions, but granting of legitimacy to people, to Jews who hold other positions, was a very big conversation all across the Jewish world. So in this summer, Rabbi Sharon Kleinbaum, who was the rabbi of Congregation Betzim HaTorah, which is a gay synagogue in Greenwich Village, gave a sermon, whatever it was, in which she talked about the Israelis who died and also mentioned the names of, I think, Palestinian children who had died as a result of the conflict in Gaza. And her congregants were outraged that she had included the Palestinian dead in her speech. So this turned out not to only be an issue within our community, this is an issue across the Jewish community as to how we grant legitimacy to people whose points of view, positions, or way of looking at things may be different than our own. But I don't have to worry. My students sometimes ask me, I grew up in Brooklyn in the black hat world, the Jewish world, whatever it is, and so my modern Orthodox students are fascinated. This is like a different planet. They want to have long conversations, you know, about what's wrong with the Kollel system or something. And I say to them, I have no desire to sit here and talk to you about what's wrong with the system that you're not part of, that you don't live in, that you don't connect to. If anybody ever invites me to come and talk to them, I can tell them what I think they need to fix. But if I'm telling you what you need to fix, you have plenty of stuff to fix without worrying about what they need to fix and what you think might or might not be wrong with the Kollel system. So how's about, instead of talking about what's wrong with them over there, how's about we talk about what's wrong with us over here? Because that's a much more productive conversation, starting with the fact that we have the power to fix what's wrong with us, and we don't have the power to fix what's wrong with them. So I have no desire to sit around and talk about what's wrong with the body politic in Israel or in Congregation Betzim HaTorah, except by purpose of analogy to say this is not only our community's issue, but it is our community's issue as well, and to think about how we engage in these conversations of issues of enormous import, of issues we feel very strongly about, and in issues, to go back to the beginning, where we are comfortable saying, Ani Mamin Be'emunah Shleimah. We don't lack clarity in our positions or conviction in our positions, and nevertheless, that we get ourselves to a point where we as a community are able to say, I think you're doing the wrong thing, but I recognize you are doing it because you think you're doing what's right by the Jewish people. I think you're doing the wrong thing, but I recognize that you are doing it because you think you are doing what's right by God. I think our ability to have that kind of conversation or discourse as a community that does not sacrifice at all our ability to say, in fact, I think you're doing the wrong thing, but also refrains from drawing a circle and throwing people out of it, from delegitimating, it's not, you know, other Jews, and then it becomes other Orthodox Jews, and then it becomes the guy next door to me. We keep drawing circles and tossing people out of them, and we can maintain every bit the conviction in the rightness of our positions, and every bit of the conviction in the wrongness of somebody else's positions, without that kind of small-minded certainty that Rav Aaron is talking about, which delegitimates other people and which limits the scope of our thought. I'll take a question, and I don't know if I'm supposed to end at 11 or 11:10 because we started late. If you have a few more minutes, we can talk about faith and doubt.
I get your point here, and I agree that we cannot be closed-minded. On the other hand, there are two. You have to differentiate between people who live in Israel and people who don't live in Israel. And first of all, I would also say that the animosity ran both ways. As much as the animosity ran on the people who didn't like what Ruben usually said, when you talk about this, we do have to consider what they're
doing. Sorry about that. Hold on. Sorry.
Yeah. On the other hand, if you look at the left in Israel, they are very anti-religious. They would like to have a Jewish state, many of them, that is not even Jewish. There is that trend in Israel, too. And you have to draw a line somewhere and say, you know, if your views are you don't want a Jewish, it's Jewish state that's really Jewish. A Jewish state that we don't keep anything kosher. A Jewish state where you're entitled to your religion, but I'll do everything to make your life miserable. You can't, there comes a point where you can have to deal and say, I am drawing a line. And that is less, let's say, in Israel as it is out of Israel, because many of the people who are part of J Street or even the anti-Zionist Jews don't have your education and may not have your knowledge of Jewish history to say that these defeatist attitudes in prior periods and prior centuries have caused loss of Jews.
So a few things. First of all, we're putting J Street on the table. Jeremy Ben-Ami, the founder of J Street, is a veteran of Tzahal. Okay? Jeremy Ben-Ami, you can disagree with his politics, that's fine. You can all disagree with his politics. You cannot disagree with the fact that Jeremy, I don't presume to to know the life history of everyone in this room, but I'm going to guess that Jeremy Ben-Ami has put his life on the line for the state of Israel more than most of us have, if not all of us in this room. Wait one second. So when people say, now again, that is not the same thing as saying, I think they're wrong. I think they're totally wrong. I think their approach is not just wrong, but harmful. That's different than saying Jeremy Ben-Ami is a self-hating Jew, Jeremy Ben-Ami is this, is that. I understand. But that kind of rhetoric, which plenty of people say, let's just say, within and out of our community, but that's it. B, in terms of the left in Israel. Again, to me, my talking about the left in Israel is like my talking about what Lakewood should be doing differently. I have no voice, no audience, no ability to speak to the left in Israel. People should be speaking to the left in Israel, so they should be speaking to the left in Israel. But I have to speak to the students I can speak to the congregants. My husband's a shul rabbi, so I get to two congregants here also. To the congregants I can speak to those of you who voluntarily come to have me chew your ear off, and I get to say what I think are important things our community needs to think about and work on. The fact that other people have important things they need to think about and work on, too, 100%. But I don't have the ability to make them think about or work on those things. I don't have the audience. I don't have the platform. I don't have the anything. So I'm going to try to do what little I can in the community where I might get some traction. If I graduate a few more students every year who are capable of saying, not, you know, you're a shagetz, but you're so wrong, and I understand that you think you're doing God's work in the world, then I will feel like that's fine too. That's also something. And the third thing I will say is, as with so many things, the ability to see it personally sometimes, to see a person, to know a person, to relate to a person, helps shift the way you think about things. This is certainly true, right? One of the things that has effected such a big shift within certain segments of the Orthodox community, and certainly among younger Orthodox Jews, in terms of the way they think about gay Orthodox Jews, is the fact that more people within the Orthodox community have come out as gay. And the more people who know people within the Orthodox community who come out as gay, the more the rhetoric around gay Orthodox Jews has shifted. So I have to tell you, this is nothing more than my personal experience, but it really shifted the way I think about some of these issues. When we talk about the secular left that wants to delegitimate religion in Israel, absolutely that's been an issue that Israel's been dealing with since Kom HaMdina and before Kom HaMdina, right? The secular socialist left that had no truck with religion, But if I don't talk about that, right, if I don't go back to, you know, David Ben-Gurion and whatever, and I talk about people living in Israel today, and I talk about the experience of what it is like to be a secular Israeli who lives in Israel today, and whose only interaction with religion is my interaction with the Rabbanut when I want to get married, and my interaction with the Chevra Kadisha when I need to bury my family member, right, then my perspective goes from some kind of global statement about the left that wants to understanding what somebody else's experience was like. I had a conversation with a former student of mine who graduated from Columbia, and I asked him what he got. Like, one standing on one foot, right? What did you get out of 4 years of a Columbia education? And he said what he got out of a four-year Columbia education is that different people have different narratives, and other people have narratives different than your own, and you have to be able to understand that here somebody's narrative is different than your own. So when I taught in SAR, we had a Hebrew teacher who came from Israel. His wife was a lawyer who was doing some kind of fellowship at Columbia University. So he's an Israeli. He altogether was not a language teacher. He was a social worker, but he needed a job in America. The way American high school work, any person, any Israeli who speaks Hebrew could teach Hebrew in American high school. That's true too. And it probably has something to do with the quality of our degree education, but that's another. So at some point I came to realize that because his wife was in Columbia, he lived in Washington Heights, and we live here. And it seemed to me unconscionable that this man had been teaching in a frum school for 2 years and had never been at a Shabbos meal or a Yom Kippur meal. So my husband and I invited him and his wife to come join our family for Shabbos meal. He did a couple of times. You know all the jokes they tell you about the Israelis, like, who don't know anything? This is what we're talking about. I said we're going now for Netilat Yadayim. He didn't know what Netilat Yadayim was. Like, we're talking about somebody who doesn't know anything. Anything about what it means to be an observant Jew. But they were lovely and interesting. We had them at our Shabbos table a couple of times, and they enjoyed my kids' company. My kids enjoyed. But they didn't get married in Israel. They didn't get married until they came to New York. Bedafka, because they were not going to get married through the Rabbanut. So they were, however long the relationship was, until they came to New York to get married. And talking to them and hearing from them, again, does it change my conviction that Jewish people should get married, l'chupa and kiddushin, and get divorced with a get? It doesn't change my conviction. But I understand how somebody feels who is being put through a completely alien, and let's be frank about it, sometimes unfriendly or unwelcoming system at very fraught, important, and thus potentially vulnerable times in their life, and I can at least hear their narrative. It doesn't mean that I think that it's a good thing for Jews to be getting married civilly or getting divorced civilly or whatever it is. That's not the logical conclusion. It doesn't mean I give up my commitment to halakhic marriage and halakhic divorce. It only means that I understand that there is an experience that is different than mine, and having heard that experience, I can engage with people, I can talk to people, I can think about people differently. And frankly, he told me in one of those conversations at our Shabbos table, he grew up, you know, somewhere on the Mediterranean coast of Israel. Probably never been to Yerushalayim in his life, didn't know a single word of that's true, and said to me very frankly, the schools he went to, he was taught to hate religion. So he was quite open about that, and I hope that his encounter with the Orthodox Jews that he had an encounter with opened his perspective on the other side as well. But I have to say again, to me, that so much is wrong on the other side does not absolve us of our responsibility to think about what we can and should be doing on our side, that's A. And B is, I think it's not just about them. This is not to me about being nice to whoever's on the other side. It's that, in part, about recognizing the Talmud Kim on the other side. But it is also very much about who we want to be as a community, how we want to be as a community, how we want to engage with complicated and controversial ideas, how we want to engage with other people. So to me, this is not just about being nice to Yenim over there. This is about who we and how we want to be. And I apologize because we aren't going to get to Faith and Doubt today, so I'll have to leave that for another time. Thank you.